Vincent Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.
Novelist Vincent Cunningham.
Yes.
Do you read the reviews of your work?
There have so far been 7 reviews of this
7
book.
That indicates that the answer is indeed yes.
I have read every one of them, word after word after word.
More than once, possibly?
All of them more than once.
All of them more than once.
I think I would be such a hypocrite if, having the job that I have,
right,
I then decided, like, reviews don't matter to me. Of course. I want to know what my work occasions when it steps into the world. Of course.
What have your feelings been? I mean, the tables have been turned. The critic has become the criticized.
6 of the 7 have been very nice.
I like those odds.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Vincent Cunningham.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
And I'm Naomi Fry. Each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. Hello, my friends.
Hello.
Hey.
How's everybody feeling today?
Oh, could not be more excited for this episode.
Special time in a young boy's life.
It's a very special time in a young boy's life. It's a very special episode of Critics at Large today because we have a very exciting development to discuss, which is the release of our own Vincent Cunningham's debut novel, Great Expectations.
True.
Out this week. Go and get it. But just to start out with a quick précis, Vincent, if I may.
Please.
The book is told from the perspective of David, who is an early recruit to the presidential campaign of a certain charismatic black senator. The novel spans 18 months in David's life, in which he starts to learn the rules of the world he finds himself in and consider his place as an individual within it. This, you know, is an environment that Vincent knows well, as he spent time working for the Obama campaign in 2008. Does that sound
right.
Okay?
That is right. Having written it, that is. I mean, I couldn't summarize it better.
I mean, we have the author right here.
He's right here in the very room with us. He's willing to submit to his fellow critics.
It's true.
That's a rare thing.
It's true.
Here he is. Great Expectations, Vincent's novel, is a prime example of a Bildungsroman, the kind of novel of education where a character passes from youth into maturity and develops in the process. And the book has a lot to say about hope and disillusionment, which are key ingredients in any great coming-of-age story, and also about power, which has become an object of fascination within this genre. And it seemed to me that the Bildungsroman has been undergoing a shift recently. And we have the classics of the genre, of course. What are some of your favorites?
Great Expectations is a great one to mention, the Dickens book.
From 1861.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are countless entries. We're talking about the novel of education in which a young person goes out into the world, leaving behind the family life, the small cocoon of childhood, and enters fully into adult experience or something like it. You know, I think immediately of The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce from 1916, in which Stephen Dedalus, Joyce's alter ego, leaves behind his family and the very cloistered Catholic upbringing he had and seeks his fortune in art.
When I think of a Bildungsroman, one of my favorites is Charlotte Bronte's novel Jane Eyre from 1847. You know, born in impoverished circumstances as an orphan, then becomes kind of quote-unquote self-actualized as a governess, but basically seeks her fortune and learns about love and power and politics, I guess, broadly conceived in the larger world.
Yeah, one of mine is Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison's first novel, 1952, which, you know, a young man takes off. He literally leaves an educational environment and goes on a weird, surreal trip through the intellectual currents of his time, whether they be black nationalism or the black conservatism of Booker T. Washington, bumbling and leaving, in some ways, trouble in his wake as he moves through these currents.
And we'll discuss several more over the course of the next 45 minutes or so. But we'll also talk about how the Bildungsroman has been kind of like reconfigured to fit our contemporary era, and Vincent's novel is one example of this tendency. And so we want to talk a little bit about what this quote-unquote coming-of-age story even means in 2024, and consider what it says about our relationship as individuals to all sorts of larger, possibly oppressive institutions. So, that's today on Critics at Large. Politics, power, and the new Bildungsroman. Okay, so let's talk about Great Expectations.
Let's.
It has just come out this week, Vincent. But obviously, it's a novel.
Yes, yes.
Which means you've been working on it for years.
That's right.
How many years?
I started a version of it in 2013, which is more than 10 years ago. And then in 2016, I got rid of all but one page and started over again.
All but one page?
Yeah. So 2016 to 2021, which is when I sold it based on the draft that I had written of it.
That's so interesting. But maybe let's start with you giving us a capsule.
Yeah.
A brief capsule of what the book is about as you see it.
Sure, yeah. Great Expectations is about a young man in his early 20s named David Hammond. And as many of us are at this time in our life, David is in many ways at sea. He's a young father. He has flunked out of college. He is sort of just trying to make his way. And as has been one of the patterns in my life, he stumbles into things. And the big thing that he stumbles into is a presidential campaign. He's tutoring a young kid, and a parent of the kid is somebody who is an acquaintance of and a fundraiser for this, as you say, young black senator from Illinois. And this accidental series of events kind of spins him off into an adventure, learning about a newly intense form of citizenship, being involved in the currents of his country and the center of its like sort of power in a new way. He's a fundraising staffer on this campaign. And so he comes into acquaintance with people that are richer than he ever has noticed and closer to the levers of power than ever. So it tracks the campaign from beginning to end with David on some level, you know, through his thinking and his ruminating on art and sex and God and other things, also sort of meeting out his own sort of remembered biography, and seeing where this, like, the sort of distant charismatic figure, but also the whole machinery, which he calls, like, a sort of, like, a great whale, how this moves through the currents of not only his life, but of the country as he comes to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It is so interesting to hear you use the word citizenship and describe this as an experience of citizenship because—
I found that interesting too.
Yeah, because the thing that strikes me about David Hammond, this character, is the sense of apartness and the sense of being an outsider observing. He is a critic in a lot of ways.
Yes.
I mean, he starts to run in this very elite circle because he's raising money from people who have a lot of it.
That's right.
And he's suddenly in this 1% of the 1% kind of world, you know, whether it's a famous music producer or a financier whose name most people would not know, but who controls vast amounts of wealth. So to my mind, some of that takes him a bit out of the experience of citizenship as well. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask you about, if I may.
Please.
And in the book is, you know, all right, we call it, the character is called the candidate. This is, I love this kind of coy reference to a person we all know well.
That's right.
But who is not going to be named by name. But, you know,
the love that dares not speak its
name. It's the love that dares not speak its name. One thing that you know, I really associate with Obama's candidacy, of course, is this sense of groundswell, young people getting super caught up in it, people joining together and feeling like part of something. And yet here we have a character who is exactly the age to be swept up in this and is participating very directly in the campaign, but stands apart from and is critical of this excitement. Is that right? Like, is that the right description of his positioning?
I think that's right. Or I think one way to say it is the kind of personality who does get caught up and on some level has, through his participation in many other ways of living, whether they be religious, aesthetic, otherwise, has become a kind of critic of getting caught up, has felt it in himself, and therefore is accustomed to the patterns and the rhythms of being caught up, and therefore can, at certain moments at least, sort of double strand his thinking, get caught up and interested in what it means to get caught up at the same time. Right. Yeah. I think that's the most interesting kind of sort of critical posture that doesn't say I'm apart from the getting caught up, but says as it is happening, I can anatomize it even as it happens to me.
Yeah. It's kind of a habit. The character David has a constant habit. It's sort of habitual self-reflection. And this happens whether in the political circumstance of a candidate's campaign, you know, and kind of observing a kind of participant observatorship, you know.
That's right.
Of kind of the environment he finds himself in. It happens in church, you know, because that's a big part of the book as well. You know, David grew up in a religious household and kind of grew up in the church and has been a participant, observer, and distance in that institution for a very long time. It happens in matters of love, you know, which I think is really interesting, and matters of family. I should note that David is a young father. You know, he drops out of college because he gets a girlfriend pregnant. Ends up having a baby. And the interesting thing is just that this sort of Obama figure is called the candidate. The child is called the baby, right? But we don't have a name. You know, we have the baby, just like we have the candidate. But do you think this tendency to self-reflection about the institutions in which a young person, a young protagonist finds himself or herself is something that's germane to the Bildungsroman, and it's kind of something that you were thinking about when you were writing it consciously? Or did it just kind of like come out of the story you were trying to tell in a more organic way?
Right. Yeah. I think there is some aspect of Bildungsroman that is about a growing awareness of self and others, a growing sensitivity to a kind of environment. If you write one in the third person, I think a lot of that awareness is built through narration and less through the active thinking and critical disposition of the character in it. So that might be a difference.
And your book, we should just clarify, is in the first person.
And my book is written in the first person for all sorts of reasons, because I like to read sort of like campaign-based memoirs, because I like that weird frisson between life and fiction that becomes even stickier when you put something in the first person. There's a lot behind that decision. Also, I just love writing in the first person. But also, I think we famously did an episode about criticism. And we talked at the beginning about the critical disposition. What kind of person is the critic? And so I think if you put someone who is of critical disposition into a novel, and then you track the moments at which that part of the brain kicks in, it becomes not just a way of novelistic seeing, but also a way of illustrating a personality tick. It's like when things get their most intense, and I don't know about you guys, but this is part of my not just like aesthetic makeup, it is part of my psychological makeup, is that when experience becomes its most intense and difficult is the moment when I do that sidestep and start to think about it in a different way. And it has become, you know, I've learned how to make money based on that ability, but it is primarily psychological, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the reason that if you track the moments when this character does that, I think it starts to become part of a portrait.
Okay. So may I do something? May I take a liberty? We got to go to the text.
Let's go to the text.
We got to go to the text.
Let's go to the text.
And I think if we don't inform the listeners that Vincent Cunningham writes prose the way an Olympic ice skater skates, we would be doing a deep disservice. I mean, he is gliding. He is jumping. He is leaping.
Wow.
He's doing triple axel. He's landing on his toe and off he goes again.
You know how I love a sports reference.
Well,
this is blowing my mind.
That's basically what I can.
Oh,
that's, this is the one I can provide.
Listeners, if you could see me blush.
I mean, if I was truly in sync with this novel, it would be a basketball reference.
What if I suddenly do it? I'm like, I know nothing about basketball.
He was running down the court and
he strikes.
Well, okay. So there is, maybe I should ask you to read it, Vincent. I think that probably makes a lot more sense.
I will. Direct me to the text.
I'm directing to the text. We're on page 61.
I should say.
Do you want to set us
David,
up?
Yeah.
Set us up.
David is in Martha's Vineyard for the first time. He's traveled there by boat and is in the room in, you know, in someone's house that he is sort of designated to stay at after an event has happened. And he is up in a room, and in the room is a bookshelf, and he decides that he wants to read something. And so we see him start to, like, select something to read. And then he starts to think about kind of his life as a reader and all the effects that writing has had on him in his life. Is that fair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. David says, over time, I started to resort to novels on roughly the same grounds as he used to read the scripture. Despite the fakenesses of character and plot, my antic, self-soothing style of reading, each paragraph combed quickly but repeatedly at a sweeping diagonal angle, hoping to swallow whole each chain of thought, gave me the impression, maybe it was a delusion, that I could glimpse past the narration and see the heart, hear the voice of the novelist herself, the real person at the desk, squirming stylishly to be seen. I thought of fiction as a flexible tarp, easy to pierce and asking to be pierced, thrown over an attempt at correspondence.
Okay.
Lovely.
Absolutely glorious,
thank
first
you.
Of all, on the level of the prose.
Thank you.
Let's acknowledge that and just get that clear. But one thing I love about this passage is you are winking at us a bit. Are you asking stylishly to be seen? What is for you the difference between your eye and the eye in the book? I'm so excited to ask this question.
Please.
Because as a critic, I often write about books that are like this, in which the protagonist, you know, usually we call them autofiction, and I'm curious as well to know if that is a label that you embrace, reject, or somewhere in between. But usually, you know, when I'm thinking of autofiction, I'm thinking of a writer who is using a version of themselves in a novel, and sometimes it hews really closely to experience, sometimes it departs radically from experience, but there's a kind of play that can happen with this alternate person. So, yeah, are you squirming stylish to be seen behind the eye of this book?
Yeah, I think that is such a good account of a certain kind of writing that uses the eye as a site for a kind of play, a glinting in between something like reality and something not like it. David Hammond shares a lot with me in terms of his autobiography, and yet things happen to him that never happened to me in many cases, and sometimes things happen to him that did happen to me. So there is a back and forth between that, the sort of a looseness between writer and narrator that is interesting to me. But in a paragraph like that, I always love novels that at some point try to inform you of how to read them. Do you know what I mean?
It's absolutely.
Like, this is the kind of book that this is. And this is, to me, is the great utility of books that have other books in them. I tend not to trust books that don't reference any other books in them. It's like, you know, as much as the novel comes from life, the novel also comes from other novels.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I have loved books which create confusion with the first person. So I'll just mention one. One of my favorite books is called Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. It's by the great, one of my heroes, James Weldon Johnson, who was a songwriter, wrote what we call the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. He wrote this book. It's kind of what we call now a passing narrative. He, like, this guy who, through the world of art, through his talent as a pianist, slowly, as a light-skinned black man, just, like, slips into the white world. He released this book anonymously, and everybody thought it was a true account until James Weldon Johnson, much later, comes up and claims it as a work of fiction. That kind of tricksterism through the eye, you know, and it happens in many different ways, is something that I've always been interested in. But I don't think that, you know, what we call autofiction, which I guess takes many forms, but it that's not the only way to do that, you know.
So it's not a Knausgard, you know, Knausgardian
in some ways,
exercise.
Yes, in some ways it does. Like, you know, I think one facet of the autofiction, as we call it now, Christian Lorenzen, the critic, has talked about this, is that it's like what it really is the Künstlerroman, the coming of age of an artist. So it takes a lot of attention to art. If you look at, you know, Rachel Kusk, Teju Cole, Ben Lerner, the people that we group under this category, that is something that they have in common. But autobiographical or semi-autographical fiction vastly predates that movement. One of my favorite novelists is Saul Bellow, who you can track his real-life friendships and love affairs and everything else through his fiction.
Mm.
And even though things happened to those narrators that did not happen to Saul Bellow, it's very closely implicated, very intimate with his life. So that's something that I've always liked. I wouldn't even know how to classify mine along those axes because I was thinking about many kinds of novels that do that, not just what we call autofiction.
Vincent, so the novel is set right before And right after the financial crash of 2008, kind of a defining moment for a generation. We all remember it. And David is coming of age under very specific conditions. How does that context shape the novel as you see it?
Well, it happens in the novel at an interesting time for David. It happens just before a major plot point. And in both cases, it acts as a kind of apocalypse in the classical sense, something that unveils something else, a crisis that has a clarifying effect. Mm-hmm. David, as he watches the financial collapse happen, first of all, he sees a change in the candidate, that is, a malleability that he had already started to notice, a sort of responsiveness to effects that changes the whole presentation of personality that he'd also already kind of noticed, but becomes even starker in this moment, occasioned by this crisis. You think about the old Rahm Emanuel quote that's kind of terrifying, like, never let a crisis go to waste. You see this sort of opportunism, I guess, in the candidate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it also reveals to him how different he is still from the rest of the world around him, where, of course, the financial crisis would end up having an effect on us all, but all of a sudden his distance from, like, the true mechanisms of power that would make some, you know, some Lehman banker jump out of a window or whatever, all of a sudden he feels strangely untouched by that.
Yeah.
My checking account, nothing changed about it. I remember feeling that way. It's like, later on, I guess it would affect me. But at the moment, it was like, oh, well, I'm very different almost categorically from the scenes of panic, whatever, that we saw on TV. But also, I think, in the same way that the Obama campaign would become a sort of marker generationally, the financial crisis, I mean, I was in high school when 9/11 happened. I was, like, at the tail end of college when Katrina happened. And then I was in my early 20s when the financial crisis happened. And I think that sequence, for me, is definitional of a generation of people, political thinkers, social thinkers. Again, this fraught word, a way to be a citizenship that is also fringed with a kind of criticality, that sense in me was born in that tripartite sequence. And so, for me, it's really interesting. If you think of this as a coming of age, that might be the strongest aspect of that moment, even though it's just David walks through it as a sort of passage. But I think hopefully the effect on the reader is that you're watching it with a sort of dramatic irony. It's like, this is even stranger than you think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it also involves these two forces of kind of seduction and disillusionment that the Bildungsroman kind of hovers around.
That's right.
In a minute, power, seduction, and disillusionment, and how they shape the new Bildungsroman. Critics at Large will be right back.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay, you guys, let's go deep.
I am so ready for it.
Let's go deep.
Let's go deep. We're talking Great Expectations, but we also want to talk about how these, you know, themes that appear in the book, power, disillusionment, seduction, dare I say, have also been central to coming-of-age stories from the very beginning, from the dawn of time. We have always loved coming-of-age stories. Although, in fact, Alex, I believe you hate the term coming of age.
Okay, I want to clarify something here. This came up The right way to say it is I used to hate the term coming of age.
So you came of age.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Coming of age.
I came of age and I thought, you know, I used to just find it very condescending to children, basically, when I was a child. And you were handed all these books that were about kids who were like slightly older and were having some kind of experience and puberty was involved. And I just felt gross. Yeah. I just thought, this is gross. Respect me as I am now. You know, I understand going to change.
I like that.
Let's not refer to this huge part of life as if what comes before doesn't matter. And I would actually stand by that. But now I do understand there is, you know, now that I've come of age, as you say, Nomi, there is something to the phrase.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's more.
It's a journey.
It's a journey. Exactly. It's about the process, right?
Yeah.
It's not about saying that what came before isn't in itself important or meaningful.
It just used to gross me out and no longer does.
I mean, it has. I understand what you're saying. It has kind of a whiff of like books about getting your period.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And little did I understand how few of the great texts of coming of age really had anything to do with getting your period. And in fact, there should be many more on that subject.
That's absolutely true. I couldn't agree more.
Fair enough.
Let's talk a little bit about maybe a couple of the pillars of the Bildungsroman genre. I know, Alex, that you love Flaubert's Sentimental Education from 1869.
What you say could not be truer. I love Sentimental Education.
I love it, too.
And I know Vincent does also.
I do.
And what I want to say something quickly about titles, if I may, which is that so many of the books that we're thinking of and that we can discuss, these coming-of-age books, could either be called Great Expectations or Sentimental Education.
That's right.
Like Vincent's Great Expectations could also in some way be called Sentimental Education.
Oh, 100%.
It
really shares a lot with it, I think.
It does.
Those are the two things. You know, that's what growing up and learning about the world is all about. And so, okay, Sentimental Education by Gustave Flaubert, published in 1869, is about a young man, Frédéric Moreau, a law student from Normandy, who comes to the center of it all, to Paris, in order to seek his fortunes, falls hopelessly in love with an older married woman who remains this constant throughout his life.
As one does.
Falls
in France.
Definitely in France.
Yeah.
Falls in with a group of men, young men kind of like him, who are interested in politics and also obsessed with aesthetics, and lives his life as the great political revolution of 1848 in France gets underway, in which the monarchy is shoved aside for briefly, they did not know, but briefly, a republic. And, you know, there are so many things I love about this novel, and I think one reason it's endured is that it really describes things that all youth go through, like political idealism, political disillusionment, the feeling of being part of a group and the power of being part of a group versus also the sense that, just as we were discussing with Vincent's narrator, David, you stand apart and aside because, of course, you do. You're seeing it all through your own.
It's the only way to see.
Through your own eyes. And, you know, the other thing that I love about this novel is put best by Flaubert himself, where he said that he wanted to write the moral history of the men of my generation, or more accurately, the history of their feelings. And then he said of his book, "It's a book about love, about passion, but passion such as can exist nowadays, that is to say, inactive." So it's a lot about people who talk a big game but can't quite live up to that, which I think may also have a lot to do with David,
100%.
Vincent's narrator. I just can't say enough about how much I love this book. Also, I think one reason I love it, which is a bit depressing, is that politics has not advanced so far from where it was in mid-19th century France.
Yeah.
Like, there's great stuff here about socialism. You know, Flaubert writes, although these theories, meaning socialism and democracy and other things, were about as new as love and war, and although in the past 40 years they've been discussed enough books to fill several libraries, they still terrify the middle classes as much as a shower of meteorites, arousing the hatred which an idea produces just because it is an idea, a detestation which later rebounds to its glory and ensures its superiority over its enemies, however mediocre the idea itself may be. Okay, so that is political cynicism, political idealism and cynicism encapsulated in a paragraph. We haven't moved so far away from that, I think.
Yeah, no. I mean, Vincent, what do you think vis-a-vis, you know, I mean, this discussion of politics and, you know, political institutions and what they might mean to a young man who is discovering himself, discovering his passions. How do you see that figuring in your book and your attitude towards that?
Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned seduction. I think this is totally right. I'm always, listeners, I'm sorry, yammering on about love. But I do think that it is a way that, at least for me, it is something that structures all of our actions. It is no mistake that, like, there's a love affair, which I should point out, was true to Flaubert's life. He fell in love with
That's
an older
right.
woman, and if you read his letters and his journals, it haunted him for his whole life. And this is the greatest expression of this true experience in his life. The juxtaposition of this, the constancy, but also several crises in this love, the way that, you know, the beautiful part about this book, what makes it a true and lasting work of art, is the patterning between the stages of this love and the various, let's call them, love relationships that lead to different kinds of political experimentation and political groupings that Moreau walks through. Coming of age, or simply sort of coming into what we call knowledge, and we try to rationalize as a function of reason, you know, a scientific testing out until we come to know, is really better described as like a series of affinities. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to see what a process of mutual seduction between us and many different ways of seeing and thinking until we tie the knot with a worldview.
Yeah, what sticks, what gets you, what keeps you.
That's right.
And what kind of person you become, end up becoming as a quote-unquote adult, whatever that means, right? And, you know, it's interesting because in sentimental education, as we've said, you know, there's this love affair. And your book has a love affair, or a couple of love affairs, I guess. But there is one in particular that kind of maps in some ways onto the Flaubertian one. But the love affair in the Bildungsroman is also, as you say, with kind of a worldview, right? Or we can call it institutions,
I think.
So it's not, there are the actual, you know, sexual, romantic affairs that a character might have. But there's also the seduction of the institution, which I think your character, David, kind of like dances between being seduced and being unseduced and kind of back and forth of, a kind of jig of kind of belonging and unbelonging,
right,
as Alex has pointed out. But I think that might be one thing that we're seeing in kind of contemporary versions of the Bildungsroman, Great Expectations among them, but there's also a couple of others that I think we can bring up and talk about.
Yeah.
One of them is a memoir that was published recently, last month, called Private Equity by Carrie Sun. And this is a book about a woman who became kind of a high-powered assistant to a much more high-powered hedge fund billionaire, right?
Yeah.
And this is a memoir. I mean, some details have been changed, but it's essentially the story of 2 years that this woman, Carrie Sun, spent at the service of this incredibly powerful man who, in a lot of ways, represents might of financial institutions in our age and in contemporary America. She gets enmeshed in an institution, in a very powerful institution, and then becomes disillusioned in some ways, comes to terms with her partners from these institutions.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Private Equity, I have to say. I mean, it is a seduction story, as we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's about a young woman who actually thinks she's pretty disillusioned at the start, which is also so touching and says a lot about, you know, when what youth is in a lot of ways, where you think you've kind of seen it all and you understand how the world works. Mm-hmm. She used to work in finance. She dealt with horrific sexual harassment, which she actually writes about in this kind of tragically equanimous,
detached way.
Like, well, that just kind of goes with
this
the territory, but it's really gross and not great. And then she throws in her lot, as you say, Nomi, with this billionaire who is called in the novel Boone Prescott, which I happened to find to be very effective. A bit of
to me, it felt, I mean, I know, I didn't love it. I didn't love the name. I didn't love the name. It felt a little bit, but although, you know what? I mean, my first thought of it was like, this is such a soap opera name, you know, but it's kind of, he is the modern day romantic hero.
Yeah, she wants him to represent something which to my mind is impossible, which is the good billionaire. She wants to believe that he is using his wealth for good and kind of wants to sign on to that idea. I mean, a lot of these stories, it does remind me of Vincent's book, I have to tell you, Vincent, in that it is about the attraction to a charismatic leader. Although one thing that I think is so interesting about Great Expectations is that unlike me, for example, or I think a lot of people from our shared generation, like David Hammond is kind of skeptical and actually very critical of Obama from the start.
Yeah.
And so he kind of needs a job. And so he winds up in this campaign, unlike the legions of college students who wanted to really be part of history. He's not very interested in thinking that he's like there when it happened. But I think Carrie Sun is interested in thinking that she can be there. Yeah. Around and understandably so, around this huge center of gravity, that she can maybe be part of this, you know, if they're going to be billionaires. Okay, put in your lot with a good billionaire who may be able to use his money to accomplish something good in the world. And needless to say, the scales fall from her eyes.
There's a really, like, chilling passage, like, juxtaposition early on in this book where Carrie is talking to the recruiter that helped her get the job. And is like, I love this job, you know, like, this enthusiastic effusion. Also, by the way, chilling is the fact that, like, the texts and emails in this book are sometimes in Calibri, which is the font of the eventually sold dead-end worker. But we could talk about that another time.
It's a great design choice.
Yes, well,
yeah,
absolutely.
The font of the oppressed.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And then, right after that, she has this bizarre meeting with Boone where he has sent her, like, a picture of his child or something like that. And she, like, looks at it and is like, oh, that's nice, whatever. Then she comes into one of their meetings. He says, did you get my email? And she says, yeah, it was so sweet. I thought I would talk to you about it when we got to the meeting. He's like, I need a reply to every email I send you.
Even if it's just a picture of
even
my child.
Even if it's just a picture.
Yeah, he says,
I need
to know that
you read
it,
everything
yeah.
that I wrote or sent. And it's just like, first of all, it's the sort of the classic contemporary complaint of works and encroachments onto your private time. But it's also just a way of showing the sort of, the pickup artists call it negging, the way that like a seduction has these like, these patterns of attraction and repulsion and then attraction again, and I've got you, and then I lose you, and then I've got you again. That pattern is so interestingly woven.
Sure. One thing that struck me as interesting and why I think in some ways, even though Sun is, you know, largely disillusioned and purports to be like, I've extracted myself from this world. This is kind of in some ways an indictment of this world that I really wanted to belong to and I no longer do. When they have their meetings, her meetings with Boone, Prescott, or, you know, another boss, without further comment, she calls these meetings sits.
Yeah.
Boone
sit
and I
a
had
noun.
A sit. Mm-hmm. Sit as a noun. And it doesn't even, you know, and it never, she kind of like never comments on it in any way and says, haha, this is what we used to call it. And because I wasn't familiar with this term, not being from this world, it seemed to me so, it like was like, you know, nails on a chalkboard to me.
Yeah.
And the fact that she continued to use it as if it's kind of like the term of art, I mean, as if it's just
That's
like,
right.
this is what it's
this
called.
Is what we call it.
This is what we call it, suggested to me that you can't completely extract yourself from an institution and from a way of thinking that has Stockholm syndromed you into believing a certain, you know, worldview, even if you mostly have or you think you
That's
have,
right.
you know,
yeah.
you can't completely divorce yourself from the yeah. world in which you were enmeshed.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
I think.
Yeah, I find sit and what it represents touching, actually. It's the lexicon of that world that is so leaked into consciousness that it cannot be eradicated. It also makes me think of the position of writers who want to chronicle what their experience has been and want to reflect on the worlds that they've been a part of, that they've been very much within, even as they've kind of personally stood apart. I mean, that kind of tension is often one thing that I do love in a Bildungsroman.
It's so funny because when you're up close with either history or an institution in the form of, you know, let's say a private equity outfit with Carrie Sun, when you're up close to it, it almost obscures your view of the outside such that, and I think this has to do with the sit thing, you don't know when you're in something which parts to explain to an outsider.
Yeah.
Because they become the so total a reflection of reality for you. One thing that I love to track in books that have to tell you about a world is what it does stop to explain. Like, Carrie Sun tells us what a fund of fund is.
Sure.
She tells us lots of, like, there's a lot of...
I still don't understand,
I don't
by the
understand.
Way.
I yeah.
was
please.
Like, talk down to me, Carrie Sun. Try to explain to us, if you dare, what it is that you do all day. yeah. in finance.
She did a great job of not making those passages be boring or anything.
Yeah.
But it's like the difference between that and the sit is mm-hmm. is maybe precisely,
yes.
you know, you can,
yes.
the psychology, you know, what do I think is part of this world and what do I think is part of the world?
Yeah.
You know, how do I make a distinction between those things?
So that's where the genre has been, but let's bring it into the current climate of 2024. Where might the coming-of-age story go next? Critics at Large will be right back.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Okay, guys, we're back. And I want to talk, I think, a little bit, and I want to hear from Vincent and from you, Alex, what you guys think about, you know, Vincent's novel is obviously it's about the dawn of the Obama era,
mm-hmm.
a moment of great optimism.
Great expectations.
And great expectations.
That's right.
And many of us remember it at this point in time with, you know, perhaps, you know, some... a tear in our eye because we think about where we've been or where we thought at least we were and what we thought we were going to, hoped we were going to, and where we are,
mm-hmm.
which is a very different place with a very different kind of tonality, I guess.
Yeah.
And maybe we can start, Vincent, by hearing from you what it was like for you to write about the Obama era at a very different time. You know, you were writing this during the Trump presidency.
That's right, yeah.
And it's coming out in an election year where we are, you know, we have these two candidates who are, you know, each in their own way not Obama.
Yeah.
Or not what we thought Obama was in 2008,
yeah.
at least. So what was that like?
Well, it was absolutely fascinating to describe. Even though I really think the Obama era ended a little bit before his presidency ended with like Trayvon Martin and stuff like that. We see the rise of mass movements that crested during the pandemic and stuff like that.
Mm.
I think perhaps might be the punctuation mark on the era. But even though, so there was a period of time there, we can think of, you know, the beautiful state dinners and Michelle Obama and J. Crew or whatever. You know,
oh, my
there
God,
was a,
yeah. So much like, oh, my God, this is the dawning of a new age.
Yeah. Commons at the White House?
You know?
But. Still,
I
do think that it plateaued even before he got into office, because as we've talked about, the moment he got into office, the
disappointment started.
The first real big thing he did was a bailout for the financial sector.
Which is a part of your book as well.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting and instructive to put that next to private equity, mm-hmm. Carrie Sun, as we have, because the trajectory of that disillusionment had at its background a sort of growing awareness of the institutions that, you know, from the financial sector, certain things about the government and its intertwinement with the financial sector, it kind of provided a skeleton of what our lives are really hemmed in by. And, you know, it's another neat juxtaposition because, like, so then we have the financial crisis, and then Obama's next political opponent is not a war hero and longtime senator, but a guy whose claim to fame before he got into government was private equity, Mitt Romney, you know?
Yes.
So in so many ways, those years were a back and forth sort of dialectical conversation about government, finance, and how citizens lived their lives in the shadows of these great institutions. Mm-hmm. That was really interesting to watch, thinking of the Trump moment as the aftermath of that conversation, which redounded to, you can't trust him. Like, that was, that's what that all came out as, is these people that the Illuminati or whatever, you know, they don't care about us.
Yeah.
And so
The lizard people,
they don't, you know, they're living in a reality that not only sort of has nothing to do on the level of like morals with the rest of ours, but also is like deeply detrimental to our interests. So the day that I sent this out to a bunch of editors that I hoped would buy it was January 6th, 2021, which is, of course, the same day as the Capitol riot.
Great timing.
Wow.
So it was like, for me, it was like, yeah, cycle complete. Like, not only will there, to my mind, not at least in my lifetime, be a moment of such great hope as there was with Obama, but we are off into another thing that has everything to do. I think if the Bildungsroman has any new valence today, it is the antagonist is not like parents. It's not religion. It's not upbringing. These personal facets that you usually have to like escape to come of age.
Mm-hmm.
It's the superstructure, you know, it's finance,
so
capital F, it's government, capital G. There is this, and I'm not saying that this has never been talked about before, but I do think that people of our moment think of themselves as products of, and therefore on some level in a constant wrestling match with whether they are elite campuses, whether they are financial institutions, whether they are the workings of government, in structural antagonism. And this is the main sort of way of structuring a personality as opposed to interpersonal or whatever.
Well, yeah. I want to quibble with one thing you said, which is that this moment of hope could never happen again, because I feel, and I'm not talking, I'm not even talking in political terms.
Yeah.
I'm really talking almost in, again, in like
spiritual terms.
Well, in kind of personal terms, because I'm still trying to use this lens of both the Bildungsroman as an art form that takes into account a person's moving into the world and therefore what the world is like around the person. And also the, I think I said this before, but just to emphasize it, like the experience of reading a book like Vincent's Great Expectations is to feel, if you went through this era as I did, you're projecting yourself as well onto this and trying to map out what your own feelings at the time were, your own Bildungsroman can kind of be in some ways projected on top of the characters.
Yeah.
And the tension between the reader's experience and the character's experience, I think, is one thing that makes the book really rich and obviously will be different for each person. But the extraordinary nature of the beginning of the Obama era, of that kind of – which is exactly what you capture in the book, because your book begins with the announcement of the candidate's campaign and ends – I think it's okay to say,
yes,
with the candidates winning of the campaign.
Yes. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. He won. But that kind of huge sweep, you know, one way to see it is as a convergence of the personal, as just an emotional resonance that some extraordinary figure can bring into being for many people at the same time. And suddenly things change and things take shape. And what we think are all of our personal stories, our own Bildungsromans, are being channeled through this powerful figure whose talent, as it was with Obama's, is exactly for making you feel that you can kind of harness or yoke your individuality into this much greater purpose and machine. And I think Trump did, bizarrely, the bizarro version of that with his constituency.
Right.
Suddenly there's a voice, right? Suddenly there's a place.
And instead of a joyful union and sense of collective and sense of, you know, feeling that history has achieved a purpose and kind of reading on to history this narrative that we want it to take, in the weird Trump world, it's history has gone awry and history used to be good and now it's straight. It's become a perversion and I'm going to bring it back and follow along with me. And so there is another kind of very dark collectivity happening there. One big narrative, I mean, this is less about Obama than it is about us again, but one big narrative at the time is doom and gloom. And, you know, what is it like to be coming into the world as a young person when you think the world has nothing for you and that actually the world may end? We're living in a time where the predominant narrative is apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And like, of course, that's going to change the kinds of stories we tell about being in the world. But I also tend to look back at history and think many other apocalyptic times have taken place and still the individual finds a way
to
push through.
And things have changed. And you know, I mean, it's it's kind of like a fool's errand to be like, this is definitely the end of history. And nothing different might come in the wake of the moment where we're at. We just don't know that, which is kind of encouraging.
It is.
You know?
It is.
It's like things are terrible, but things have been terrible in the past. And then they've, you know,
and
shifted.
Then a hero comes along.
Na, 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 mm-hmm. na, na,
na. Or is it in the nature of, you know, people in their Buildings Roman era to search for a hero, and now we're sitting around saying, we thought we had ours. That. It didn't work
out. I might be talking about myself. I might be like, just the way my elders were like, just you wait and see with Obama. Like, kind of like cooling off the enthusiasm of people my age. I might just be one of those now. That might be the
Is that what your elders said? That's interesting. I mean, this is the big capital R romantic in me. But it's like, if you're 22, go out and imagine yourself in a Buildings Roman.
Yeah.
And there is something, I think, at that age, again, maybe this is just me, where you do want to narrativize your life. And life does seem like it could be a novel.
Look at social media. I mean, all we ever see is the narrativization of one's lives.
Well, to that, like the grumpy 30-something I am, I'm just going to say, think bigger. Think bigger. Think narrative. Yeah. Think big, long narrative. And in fact, think novel. Think novel because by my lights, and I'm going to come out as the romantic traditionalist I am, nothing does it like a novel,
nothing.
Folks.
That's true.
It's
and
true.
I think, and
the
I think
outside if, and the inside.
Outside and the inside. And if I may say, we have an offer right here that proves my point.
Yay, Vincent!
Thank you. To that I say thank you.
If you want to hear more about Vincent's book, Great Expectations, check out his conversation with our boss, David Remnick, on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Head on over to their feed. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will not be sorry. This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis with mixing by Mike Kutchman. And additional production assistance this week from Emily Elias. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics. And you can email us at themail@newyorker.com with the subject line critics. See you next Thursday.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.